Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a really significant legal puzzle, the ins and outs of school desegregation, through the lens of the 1984 Ninth Circuit case, Los Angeles Branch, NAACP v. LAUSD. For you who are looking to get a solid grasp on complex legal issues without, you know, wading through mountains of documents, think of this as your shortcut. This case is just a fantastic example of how legal battles around civil rights play out over decades and, well, the surprising ways legal doctrines and societal shifts intersect.
Exactly. And for this deep dive, the materials you've shared give us a great cross-section. We've got some high-level guidance on understanding the case, a detailed legal brief that really digs into the specifics, and even a standard law school brief laying out the core arguments. Yeah. So our goal really is to pull out the key legal principles at work here, map out the timeline of events leading to the Ninth Circuit's decision, and ultimately understand, you know, what the impact of that ruling was.
Okay, so to really get our heads around Los Angeles Branch, NAACP v. LAUSD, kind of need to step back and look at the giant shadow of Brown v. Board of Education.
The big one.
That Supreme Court decision in 54, as you know, declared state-sponsored segregation in public schools unconstitutional. But the journey from that landmark ruling to actually desegregating schools across the country, let's just say it wasn't exactly a quick or easy road.
Not at all.
Yeah.
The post-Brown era saw a lot of resistance and, frankly, ongoing struggles to enforce desegregation orders. It wasn't like flipping a switch. It meant dismantling these deeply rooted systems and overcoming some pretty significant social and political hurdles.
Yeah.
And that's the stage where the Crawford saga comes in. It's the immediate story behind our case today.
The Crawford saga sounds like a historical epic. What's the headline for our listeners?
Well, Crawford v. Board of Education was indeed a long and complicated legal battle playing out over almost two decades, like you said, from 63 to 81, right here in California's state courts. It started with the NAACP claiming that the Los Angeles Unified School District, LAUSD, was intentionally segregating students. Initially, California courts actually agreed, finding evidence of de jure segregation, that's segregation by law or official policy, think explicit rules.
So an initial win for the NAACP then?
Yes, but as often happens in law, the story takes a turn. That initial finding, it was later reversed. And this brings us to a real game changer.
Yeah.
The passage of Proposition I in 1979.
Prop I.
This was a statewide vote, a voter initiative, and it had a big impact on how desegregation efforts could proceed in California.
Proposition I, what exactly did that do to change things?
Well, essentially, Proposition I put limits on the power of California state courts to order mandatory busing or the reassignment of students for desegregation purposes unless those specific actions were required to fix a violation of the U.S. Constitution. It really highlights that tension you can see between state-level politics, where voters directly make decisions, and the fundamental constitutional rights guaranteed at the federal level. It's a prime example of law and society kind of bumping up against each other.
Right. So Prop I basically said state courts couldn't go further than what the federal constitution required for desegregation. Now, fast forward a few years, and we get to our main event. Los Angeles Branch, NAACP v. LAUSD in 1984. Why did the NAACP file a whole new federal lawsuit after all that happened in the Crawford case?
That's the key question we need to unpack, yeah. The NAACP, facing these new limitations on what state courts could do because of Prop I, decided to take their case to federal court. Their argument was that even after the Crawford litigation and this voluntary desegregation plan that LAUSD adopted in 81, intentional segregation was still happening in the district.
Okay, so a fresh attempt to tackle what they believe was ongoing segregation. And this is where the core legal question of the case comes in, right? Was this new lawsuit blocked by something called res judicata?
Exactly. The central legal question the Ninth Circuit had to answer was whether the NAACP's claims of continued intentional segregation had already been decided or, importantly, could have been decided in the previous Crawford case. This all comes down to the legal doctrine of res judicata.
Res judicata. Sounds very official. Can we break down that legal curtain for our listeners in a simple way?
Absolutely. Think of res judicata as a way the legal system tries to bring finality to disputes. It's the idea that once a court has made a final decision on a specific set of claims between particular parties, those same parties can't just keep coming back to court to argue the same thing all over again in a new lawsuit.
Right.
It's about efficiency and preventing endless litigation. So courts don't like legal do-overs, but as we'll see, there are some pretty important exceptions.
So it stops people from suing repeatedly about the exact same issue after a final judgment.
Precisely. And there are generally three main things you need for res judicata to apply. First, there has to have been a final decision on the merits in the original case. Second, the new lawsuit has to involve the same parties or their legal representatives, their privies as the first one. And third, the new lawsuit has to be based on the same legal claims or underlying cause of action as the original case.
Okay, that makes sense. So in NAACP v. LAUSD, the argument from the school district was essentially that the Crawford case, which had run its course, should prevent the NAACP from bringing this new federal lawsuit.
That's the argument they put forward, yeah.
Yeah.
However, the Ninth Circuit, in its decision, drew a really important line. They distinguished between claims of segregation that happened before May 2, 1969, that was the date the original trial in Crawford concluded, and claims based on acts of segregation that supposedly occurred after that date.
Ah, here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah.
Why did that particular date matter so much?
Well, it goes back to what the original Crawford lawsuit was actually about. As Judge Canby, who wrote the main opinion for the Ninth Circuit, pointed out, and this is a key quote, "The scope of litigation is framed by the complaint at the time it is filed." Think of it like drawing a box around the arguments you're making at the start. The Crawford case, at its heart, was addressing alleged segregation up to a certain point in time.
Okay.
So the Ninth Circuit reasoned that while claims of de jure segregation before that 1969 cutoff were indeed barred by res judicata because they could have been argued in Crawford, claims about new acts of intentional segregation after 1969, those were potentially new violations and therefore new claims that hadn't been decided.
That quote from Judge Canby is so crucial. The scope of litigation is framed by the complaint at the time it is filed. It sounds simple, but it has huge implications for understanding when a case is really over, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Res judicata provides that finality, but it doesn't give someone a free pass to keep engaging in potentially unlawful behavior after the first lawsuit ends.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to really grasp why the court made this distinction, we need to touch on another fundamental legal concept, the difference between de jure and de facto segregation.
Right. We hear these terms quite a bit in discussions about segregation. Can you give our listeners a quick refresher on the key difference between them?
Certainly. De jure segregation is segregation that is mandated by law or official government policy. Think back to the Jim Crow era, with explicit laws separating people by race in schools, public facilities, etc.
Yeah.
On the other hand, de facto segregation is segregation that just results from other factors, like, you know, where people choose to live or individual decisions, even if there aren't any explicit discriminatory laws on the books.
Right.
And importantly, under the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, to prove a violation, the plaintiffs generally need to show de jure segregation that the school district intentionally discriminated. So if the school district had written rules saying students of different races must attend different schools, that's clearly de jure.
And this difference was a big part of the original Crawford litigation, wasn't it? There were different opinions about whether the segregation in LAUSD was legally mandated, de jure, or just a result of other factors, de facto.
Yes, that was a major point of contention throughout the Crawford case. The California Supreme Court, in an earlier Crawford decision, actually made findings based on California state law, which had a broader reach than the federal constitutional requirements for proving de jure segregation.
Oh, okay.
The Ninth Circuit, in NAACP v. LAUSD, was operating under the stricter federal constitutional standard, requiring proof of intentional discriminatory actions. As the podcast guidance reminds us, cases like Keyes v. School District No. 1 from 73 showed how seemingly neutral policies could still be evidence of that discriminatory intent.
Okay, so for the NAACP to win their new federal lawsuit, they had to argue that LAUSD had engaged in intentional segregation after that 1969 date to get around the res judicata bar for the earlier claims. Makes sense. Now, what about Proposition I? The Ninth Circuit also had to consider whether that state law was constitutional, right?
They did indeed, and the Ninth Circuit ultimately upheld Proposition I. Their reasoning was that Prop I essentially brought the remedies available in California state courts for school segregation in line with what the federal constitution required.
Hmm. The court emphasized that while states are certainly allowed to offer greater protections or remedies than what the federal constitution guarantees, they aren't obligated to do so in the context of desegregation.
Right.
So by limiting state court remedies to the federal constitutional standards, Proposition I wasn't seen as violating any federal rights. It was simply defining the scope of remedies under state law. This really gets into the core principles of federalism, you know, the balance of power between state and federal governments.
So the state of California, through a vote by the people, could basically say, we're only going to mandate desegregation measures to the extent that the U.S. Constitution says we have to.
That's the crux of it, yeah.
Yeah.
The Ninth Circuit didn't interpret Prop I as preventing the enforcement of federal constitutional rights. Rather, they viewed it as defining how far state law would go beyond those federal requirements in providing remedies.
No, it wasn't a unanimous decision, was it? There were different opinions among the judges, adding some important nuances. That's right. And it's crucial to remember that while the majority reached their conclusion, the other judges raised some significant points. Judge Sneed, in his partial dissent, argued that res judicata should have gone even further.
Oh.
He believed it should have barred claims about alleged segregation that happened not only before the 1969 trial, but also between that trial and the state court's final order in 1981, especially because Proposition I had been passed during that time.
Interesting.
His thinking was that the passage of Proposition I kind of put all alleged segregation issues back before the state court in a later phase of the Crawford litigation called Crawford II. And the NAACP should have brought those post-1969 claims then.
Oh.
So his point really challenges the idea of a clean break at that 1969 line, doesn't it? It brings up the question of when a legal chapter truly closes.
So Judge Smead was essentially saying the NAACP had another shot to litigate those later claims in the state court system after Proposition I was enacted.
Exactly. He felt that by not raising those claims at that specific stage in the state proceedings, they should also be barred in this subsequent federal lawsuit.
Okay.
On the other hand, you had Judge Pregerson, who wrote a strong opinion agreeing with the majority. He saw the ruling as a positive step for civil rights because it gave the plaintiffs a chance to prove any intentional discrimination that might have occurred after 1969,
right,
while still allowing evidence of pre-1969 actions to help understand the district's later intentions, you know, provide context.
It sounds like Judge Pregerson viewed the ruling as finding a better balance between that legal principle of finality and the fundamental need to address potential ongoing discrimination.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And then we had Judge Poole, who agreed in part with the majority, but also expressed a concern. He worried about the practical difficulties the plaintiffs would face in actually trying to relitigate those pre-1969 claims after the state court's later Crawford II decision.
Mm.
He pointed out the time pressures and the specific circumstances after that decision, suggesting that maybe the plaintiffs didn't have a real fair opportunity to revisit those earlier claims in state court. This really highlights the real-world complexities of these legal battles and how procedural hurdles can sometimes affect the pursuit of justice.
Yeah, these different viewpoints really show how nuanced and challenging that balancing act was for the court. So for our listeners, especially those of you who are law students, what are the most important things to take away from Los Angeles branch NAACP v. LAUSD?
Well, there are several key lessons here. First, this case really underscores the core principle of res judicata and, just as importantly, its limitations. It shows us that while this doctrine aims to bring legal disputes to an end, it doesn't provide absolute protection against claims based on new violations or events that happen after the initial lawsuit.
Right, the continuing violation idea.
That's exactly. Second, it's a powerful illustration of how external factors, like voter initiatives, such as Proposition I, can significantly reshape the landscape of desegregation efforts and the legal options available. It really emphasizes that dynamic relationship between law, politics, and social change.
That right.
And finally, as the materials you provided rightly point out, this case is a critical reminder about the crucial role of timing when it comes to legal claims. Filing a lawsuit too early might mean missing out on claims that develop later, while waiting too long could lead to those claims being barred by res judicata or statutes of limitation. It's a delicate balancing act.
Absolutely. Los Angeles branch NAACP v. LAUSD truly embodies this complex interplay between established legal rules, the potential for ongoing violations of constitutional rights, and, well, the constantly evolving world of public policy, especially when it comes to something as fundamental as equal opportunity in education. So as we wrap up this deep dive, here's a final thought for you to consider. Given the court's focus on the timing of claims and the need to demonstrate ongoing intentional discrimination, how might legal strategies differ today when addressing systemic issues with long histories, like persistent inequalities in education or other areas?
Yeah.
It makes you think about the balance between achieving legal finality, that closure, and pursuing accountability for discrimination that might evolve or manifest in new ways over time.
A very important question to consider, absolutely. This case continues to offer valuable insights into the complexities of striving for equal opportunity and the enduring role of the law in that pursuit.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. We hope it's given you a clearer and perhaps more nuanced understanding of this pivotal case and its broader implications. Until our next deep dive.